Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, guest host Dr. Thomas Lynch sits down for a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Temel. Dr. Lynch is director of Yale Cancer Center and physician-in-chief of Smilow Cancer Hospital. Dr. Temel is assistant professor of medical oncology and hematology at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she joins Dr. Lynch this evening to talk about advanced lung cancer. Here's Dr. Thomas Lynch.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about what got you into lung cancer.
When I was first training in oncology, I think I was struck by both the amount of physical and emotional suffering that patients with advanced cancers like lung cancer went through. And seeing that made me interested in not only taking care of those patients clinically, but also researching ways to optimize and improve the care that they receive.
And, you know, how are we doing with lung cancer? If a patient has advanced lung cancer with disease that's spread beyond the lung itself, how do those patients do?
I think the good news is in the last couple of years, we've really seen marked improvements in lung cancer treatments. Treatments are certainly getting better, especially novel targeted therapies. And we're also seeing patients overall live longer with their disease. However, where I think we've lagged behind is in supportive care treatments for patients with lung cancer, meaning making sure that they get optimal symptom management so they can enjoy their quality of life as much as possible, be as functional as possible, be able to work and go out with their friends and family, and enjoy social time.
And Dr. Temel, when you see a patient who's got advanced lung cancer and the patient or the family asks, how long is my relative going to live with this disease? Well, what do you say?
I think that's a very important issue. I think the data tells us that overall, patients who have serious illnesses such as cancer want general amounts of prognostic information. So they want to have a general sense of how they're going to do with their disease. But how patients want to hear this information, when they want to hear it, how much information they want to receive really varies patient to patient. So I think it's important that clinicians get to know their patient and have a better understanding of what would be the optimal way for them to hear and receive this type of information.
But is, you know, some people have said, and I've heard patients tell me this or families tell me this, that you could be harming the patient by telling them that they have a bad prognosis or that they could die from their cancer. And they want to be protective of their family member. How do you react to that, and how do you deal with that with patients and families?
I think traditionally that has been a concern on the part of clinicians, that if they disclose a poor prognosis, for example, a short life expectancy, that they'll cause patients to feel depressed or feel despair, and that maybe even would have negative implications for their cancer. And what we know from recent data is that that is actually not true, that it's not harmful for patients to know their prognostic information. Patients who have had conversations with their physicians about their end-of-life care or decisions about their care are no more likely to feel depressed or panicked or even feel sad and worried. So it's not harmful to disclose that type of information to advanced cancer patients.
And I think just for our audience's benefit, who may not know a lot about lung cancer, the average person with metastatic lung cancer, how long does the average person live?
I think when people look up this type of information in the newspaper or on the internet, it can be somewhat misleading because we know that patients with advanced lung cancer who participate in clinical trials tend to be a healthier group of patients, and it's not uncommon in those situations to see people have a life expectancy of a year or greater. But for all patients diagnosed with this disease, older people, patients with other medical illnesses, the sort of average life expectancy remains less than 1 year and is about 10 months.
10 months. And do you tell patients that the average life expectancy may only be 10 months?
My general practice is to not tell patients that. Getting back to what I was saying before, I think it's very important for clinicians and patients to have an established relationship and for patients to be able to some extent, negotiate when they receive this type of information and not. think my practice style is, even when I'm first meeting patients before, for example, I administer chemotherapy, I make sure that they have an understanding that their cancer is not curable. And I think that's a very important piece of information that should always be provided to patients before they begin chemotherapy, for them to understand that the intent of the chemotherapy is not to cure their cancer.
And Dr. Tummel, you've lectured extensively on talking to patients about prognosis. Do you think it allows them to make better treatment decisions if they have a better understanding of their prognosis?
I think that is 100% true. There's been data going back as far as 15 or 20 years that tells us that patients, how they view their illness and prognosis certainly translates into decisions about their care. As a nation, we're seeing care in cancer and in other diseases become more aggressive. We're seeing patients spend more time in the hospital and less time at home. And what we know is that patients who have a faulty or overestimation of their prognosis are more likely to choose this aggressive care. And not only is that associated with a worse quality of death for patients, but also significantly worse bereavement outcomes for their family members.
And what do you mean by bereavement outcomes?
Sure. Obviously, after a loved one dies, family members go through a period of sadness and grief. And we know that that period of sadness and grief is extended and significantly worse when they view their loved one as having a poor quality of death. For example, a death that had significant pain or was in the hospital with a lot of invasive care. So patients who have a better quality of death, their family members adjust more smoothly after the patient has passed away.
Yeah. And as a doctor, how do you find the language to talk to patients about dying? It must be something that is difficult to do. And how do you do that as a clinician?
Again, I think importantly that the data tells us that patients with serious illnesses, especially advanced cancer, it's very important for them to know that their clinician is prepared for their death. So again, within the first weeks or months of meeting someone with a terminal illness, I don't necessarily think it's the right thing or necessarily appropriate to discuss their death. But as patients become more ill from their cancer and are becoming closer to the time of their death, I actually think as their care providers, we owe it to them to begin a dialogue with them about their life expectancy and about their wishes when they do become more ill. For example, do they want to be at home or in a hospice facility?
And Dr. Tummel, you know oncologists around the country, particularly those who treat lung cancer. Do you think in general that oncologists do a good job in talking to their patients about death, or do you think this is an area that we could improve upon how we do?
I think the good news is that this is becoming a more important area of research. Over the last couple of years, we've seen more data, again, telling us that patients want this type of information, even some data giving clinicians some suggestions on how to provide this information. So I think it's an area of oncology that's gaining more focus. For example, the American Society of Clinical Oncology just came out with a statement about encouraging oncologists to have these conversations earlier in the course of their disease with patients. So I think we're going to see improvements in this area in the upcoming years.
And Dr. Tummel, among the many things you do at the Massachusetts General Hospital, one of the things you do is you run the training program, which trains the future hematologists, oncologists. And how do you teach compassion? How do you teach the ability to talk to patients about death?
I think the most important way for medical students, residents, trainees to learn how to have compassionate conversations and provide compassionate care to patients is to actually see someone do it well. When you watch a clinician have very compassionate, sensitive, interested conversations with patients and families, I think that's the best way to model your own style after that. I think also, unfortunately, probably seeing clinicians do it in a poor way, see clinicians communicate poorly with patients, is also important for them to learn what not to do when they communicate with patients.
And what's an example of a clinician both doing it well and a clinician who's doing it poorly? Think back to your own training or to your own experiences of seeing it done well and then not done well.
I think one of the common mistakes that clinicians make when they're having these conversations with patients is that they don't give the patients a chance to absorb the information and to ask questions. I think clinicians get very nervous when they're having these types of conversations, so they tend to speak incessantly and not give the patient and family time to process the information and ask appropriate questions. So I think it's really important to leave adequate time to have these conversations with patients and families. I think the other big mistake that we make is we could provide the information to patients, but they come back and say, you know, but doc, I should live a year, right? Or ask some sort of hopeful question. And at that point, I will often see clinicians sort of back down and say, you know, sure, that's something to hope for. So I think it's really important to give a consistent and compassionate message so that patients and families have time to absorb the information and certainly to have a follow-up with them to see if they have any questions about the conversation.
And when you've seen it done particularly well, what are some of the things you've seen in that setting?
I think one of the most important things is just getting a sense from patients about what they're hoping for. I think as clinicians, we often think that the only thing that patients care about is how long they have to live. But often when you sit down with a patient and you ask them what they're hoping for, you know, they're hoping to get to their daughter's wedding, they're hoping to get to their son's graduation. And I think as a clinician, it helps you make decisions about the patient's care if you have a sense of what these goals and wishes are. In addition, if you have a strong concern that the patient won't be there for this major event, such as a wedding or graduation, it can be helpful, for example, to have the patient make a videotape or write a letter so that they can be there in spirit even if they're not there at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk in detail about your landmark study, which appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine about treating patients with advanced lung cancer. But before we get to that, just for the audience, I'd like you to frame what it's like to have metastatic lung cancer so that the audience can get a sense of how patients experience this disease. So someone gets diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer. They often go through some treatment. Can you tell us a little bit about what that treatment is and sort of what the natural course of the disease is so that when we talk about your study, the audience will have some way of sort of putting that into perspective?
I think one of the most important things to know is that this patient population is incredibly ill, even when they're first diagnosed with their disease, and they remain ill throughout the course of their disease. So most patients, when they're diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer, have symptoms such as fatigue or pain. In this patient population, they also have very high rates of breathing symptoms, such as shortness of breath or cough. When we give them chemotherapy, which often has significant side effects, such as nausea or fatigue, sometimes these symptoms can get better. But what we know is when you're balancing the symptoms of cancer and the side effects of chemotherapy, that overall patients tend to not feel significantly better when they're on treatment, and many of these symptoms persist throughout the course of their disease. And often in the months before someone actually passes away, the symptoms actually get much more difficult to manage. And that's when we really need assistance from specialized providers, such as hospice providers.
And does chemotherapy really help in advanced lung cancer? That's a question I think a lot of families and patients ask.
So chemotherapy definitely helps patients live longer. And to some extent, it makes them feel better. Chemotherapy can certainly improve symptoms related to cancer. So if someone has a mass that's causing them pain and that mass shrinks from chemotherapy, certainly that symptom will get better. One thing that's commonly talked about in oncology is something called quality of life, sort of how a patient feels as they're living with their disease. The impact of chemotherapy on quality of life is actually less clear. Again, chemotherapy improves symptoms, but so many components or aspects of one's life contributes to their quality of life, such as their emotional functioning, their spiritual and religious functioning, that overall chemotherapy does not significantly improve quality of life.
And Dr. Tellman, we're going to talk more about that after the break. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about advanced lung cancer with Dr. Jennifer Temmel.
There are over 11 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. Following treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Tom Lynch, and I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Jennifer Temel, and we're discussing advanced lung cancer, particularly the role that palliative care can play in advanced lung cancer. So, Dr. Temel, you're obviously an expert in the treatment of lung cancer. You're someone who's been doing this for more than a decade in terms of treating patients with advanced disease. What made you get interested in the role that palliative care can have in lung cancer?
I think simply, I didn't think as oncologists we were doing a good enough job. I think there were clearly areas where we could improve care to lung cancer patients, both in their symptom management, in providing psychological support, that is for symptoms of depression and anxiety, and also to do a better job educating patients and families about the illness, patients' prognosis, and to help them make better decisions about their care.
And what exactly is palliative care?
Palliative care is a multidisciplinary. What that means is it consists of doctors, nurses, chaplains, social workers. So it's a multidisciplinary team of clinicians whose goal is really to improve patients' quality of life. So these clinicians have specialized training in symptom management. For example, they have special training in how to manage pain, not just from cancer, but from any illness. They also have specialized training in helping deal with distress or anxiety surrounding a serious illness. And probably most importantly, meaning the training that they have that is very different from traditional oncology training, is that they have specialized training in talking to patients about their illness, their prognosis, and helping patients make decisions about their care that are aligned with their goals and wishes for the future.
And so tell me a little bit about your study. You had a landmark study, the New England Journal of Medicine, that was considered one of the most important breakthroughs in all of medicine in 2010. And tell us a little bit about what brought you to design that study and what you were seeking to learn from the trial.
Traditionally, palliative care clinicians don't see people until very close to the end of their life and often in the hospital. So, for example, if someone is within days or weeks of dying and they have issues with pain control or their family is having issues coping with the patient's death, that's traditionally when palliative care providers would be called in to see the patient. My thinking was patients with metastatic lung cancer have a short life expectancy, again, in general, of less than a year, and have an incredibly high physical and emotional symptom burden. So my thinking was, why don't we have this team of clinicians, doctors, and nurses see patients earlier in the course of their disease so they can focus on their symptom management and support beginning at the time of diagnosis and hopefully have an impact on their quality of life throughout the course of disease.
Was the resistance from your colleagues to having a second set of doctors involved in the care of the patients?
I think there was some resistance, but only in the way that as oncologists, I think we put our heart and souls into our jobs. I think most oncologists really care about their patients and do the best that they can. And I think some oncologists were worried that adding another clinician would take away from the patient-doctor bond that they already had.
So tell us a little more about the design of your study. How was the study designed, and how did you tell us about what it was designed to, the questions it was designed to answer?
So as I mentioned, palliative care traditionally doesn't see people until very close to the end of their life. And so really what our study was looking at was asking these palliative care clinicians to start seeing patients from the time of diagnosis and follow them along with the oncologist throughout the course of their disease. The design of this study was what's called a randomized study, so patients were coin flipped into either the palliative care arm or the standard care arm. Patients who were randomized to the early palliative care arm would receive the same standard high-quality oncology care that all patients at Mass General get. And in addition to that, they also saw the palliative care providers periodically throughout the course of their illness.
And what would they do when they saw the palliative care provider? Who would they see, and what would that palliative care provider do for them?
As opposed to many types of intervention studies, the sort of nature of the palliative care visits weren't scripted or prescribed, meaning they weren't required, for example, in visit one to focus on pain management, in visit two to discuss illness or prognosis. The palliative care providers were given the freedom to see the patients and evaluate them and focus on what seemed most important to the patient. So one of the main palliative care providers in the study, Vicki Jackson, would say that sometimes she would go in with an agenda to talk about coping or illness understanding, but the patient was clearly very uncomfortable in pain, so the focus of the visit became pain. Other times, she would walk into the room and expect to focus, for example, on fatigue, because the last couple of visits, they were trying medication to improve the patient's energy level, but she would open the door and the patient would say, "Am I going to die?" And clearly then the focus of that visit was about helping the patient prepare for the end of life.
And Dr. Temple, do you think that patients talk to their palliative care provider about different things than they might talk to you about?
I think as an oncologist, that's a little bit hard for me to admit, but I do think that is the case. I think there's many very compassionate and sensitive oncologists, but no matter how wonderful you are, how compassionate you are, I think patients view the oncologist as holding the chemotherapy key. And to some extent, they are afraid to be truly honest and open about all of the symptoms that they're having or all of the distress that they're going through because they want to put on a brave face and receive their cancer treatment. So I do think that patients were a little bit more willing and open about speaking more honestly with the palliative care providers.
So in your trial, you had a group of patients that saw palliative care doctors along with oncologists and a group of patients that just saw their oncologists. What were the differences between the two groups in the end?
So we were very excited to see that there were marked differences in many aspects of care in these patients. First and foremost, patients receiving early palliative care had marked improvements in their quality of life, meaning they felt better, they were able to be with their family more, they were able to be more functional. We also saw marked differences in rates of depression. Patients receiving early palliative care were significantly less likely to be depressed compared to patients receiving standard oncology care.
And why do you think that was?
One thing we know is that it wasn't from more antidepressants. In addition, antidepressants don't seem to be as useful for depression in cancer as, for example, in other illnesses. So it does seem like, again, just having that team of doctors and nurses available to talk to patients about their wishes, their fears, maybe that patients felt more prepared for what was going to happen, that their mood was just overall better.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to the improvement in quality of life and the reduction in the rate of depression, my understanding is you also showed that there was a survival benefit, that patients actually lived longer who were seen by a palliative care team.
Yes, surprisingly, we did see a survival advantage. I think when we initially designed the study, we planned to follow patients throughout the course of their disease and look at the survival rates more because we thought, boy, there might be oncologists or other clinicians out there who would think that having palliative care involved in patients would actually lead them to receive less aggressive care throughout the course of their disease and potentially be worried that their survival would be lower. But in fact, what we saw was the opposite. Patients receiving early palliative care had about a 2.5-month survival advantage compared to patients receiving standard care.
And just for the listeners, can you put that into perspective compared to what chemotherapy does for patients with advanced lung cancer?
So in general, about a 2-month survival advantage is what we discuss with patients when we're giving them chemotherapy. So for example, if you had 1,000 patients who had newly diagnosed metastatic lung cancer and half of them received no chemotherapy and half of them received chemotherapy, the patients who received chemotherapy would live about 2 months longer. So the survival difference that we saw in our study is about the same magnitude of benefit that you would see with chemotherapy.
And it also, I think one of the things I found most interesting about your study is the idea that that talking to patients about death or talking to patients about end of life did not seem to shorten their survival. If anything, it lengthened their survival. Why do you think that was?
I think it's not completely clear at this point what led to the survival advantage. I think there's many things that could have contributed to it. We spoke a moment ago that the patients receiving early palliative care had better quality of life and lower rates of depression. And we certainly know that in many advanced cancer populations, if you have a better quality of life, if you have a better mood, you also live longer. I also think one other thing that we showed is that patients received less aggressive care at the end of life. So they were less likely to receive chemotherapy at the very end of life and were more likely to be on hospice for longer. And I also think that those events contributed to them living longer with their disease.
And Dr. Temple, just recently, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services was considering this year's bill of services for Medicare recipients. And they initially had wanted to include end-of-life counseling as a covered service that a physician could provide to a patient. In the end, because of political opposition to that, the decision was made not to include end-of-life counseling as a covered service. Why do you think there's political opposition to that principle?
I guess, first of all, I should say that I think that if that had gone forward, that would have been a wonderful paradigm-changing practice. As I said earlier, I think conversations about prognosis and about decisions at the end of life are incredibly time-consuming. I think it's very hard to do it in less than an hour in many cases. So I do think having the healthcare system support these conversations and allowing reimbursement for them would have been an important change to our healthcare system. I think the nation is afraid of dying. Often when we talk about cancer, we're not having conversations like you and I are today. We're only focusing on finding the cure, finding the next best treatment. And in general, people in the United States don't want to have conversations about the end of life. So I think it's really a fear of recognizing death and dying that leads patients, that leads people to not be willing to support these types of initiatives.
And where do we go next with your work? I mean, so you've shown that at a single hospital that and in a single disease that early palliative care makes a difference. As you consider next options with your research, where are you planning on going, and what questions are you thinking of asking next?
So I think you're making a very important point. We were very excited about the results that we found. However, it was done in just a single institution at Massachusetts General Hospital and in a single patient population. So I think before we think about, for example, disseminating this model to other care centers or other hospitals, we need to do a little bit more work and figure out what are the key components of palliative care. What can we sort of export to other care centers? Does it have to be by a palliative care provider? Can it be done by nurse or nurse practitioners? And so the next step is to really try to hone down on exactly what the key components of the intervention were, and also to see if the findings will be reproducible in other cancers, for example, pancreatic cancer and breast cancer.
And do you think that the role that the palliative care provider played at the Mass General in other circumstances may be played by an internist or a family practitioner, perhaps in a more rural environment where advanced palliative care may not be available? Do you think that there are other caregivers who could provide that or play that same role that the palliative care team played in your study?
I definitely think that's true. I think even in major academic institutions like here or MGH, I think there's many primary care physicians and internal medicine clinicians that want to serve that role for cancer patients. I think a big part of this is relationship building. At Mass General, the lung cancer team has been working with the palliative care team on this type of research for over a decade. So we have a significant amount of experience co-managing patients, sharing the team, sharing how to manage their experience with their cancer. And so I think in other care settings, if oncologists could team up with other care providers, develop relationships, figure out how to navigate these roles, I think that can also have a big impact on the cancer patient's experience.
And do you see nurse practitioners as possibly performing this role?
Definitely. Right now, although palliative care is a growing specialty, there are still many areas that don't have palliative care providers. I also think nurse practitioners in general do have a different role than, for example, physicians. I think they are more focused on symptom management, often have more time to have conversations with patients about their illness and prognosis. In our study, we had several nurse practitioners participate in the palliative care intervention. So again, I think thinking about nurses and nurse practitioners doing this kind of work is an incredibly exciting endeavor.
And the last question that I suspect is on our audience's mind mind is you've accomplished a tremendous amount in the last 10 years of looking at this question. But it's also something which I think could certainly take a big personal toll, talking to patients about death and talking to patients about end of life. Do you enjoy your work, and how do you find the ability to keep going despite having lots of difficult discussions with patients?
Yes, I love what I do. I love taking care of lung cancer patients. It's sad for me when my patients die. In addition, after a patient dies, we also don't see their family members anymore. And I think those of us who take care of patient populations like lung cancer also become very close to the families. I guess how I get through it emotionally is, unfortunately, the patient is going to die whether I take care of them or not. But I feel like because I'm taking care of them, they have a better experience with their cancer. They get more support and more care. So it makes me more able to get through the day.
Dr. Jennifer Temel is Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology Hematology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Thomas Lynch is Director of Yale Cancer Center and Physician-in-Chief of Smilow Cancer Hospital. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.